Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Inside Story. I'm absolutely thrilled today to welcome Catherine Quarmby, who has written this new novel, The Low Road, beautifully written book. Now, Catherine is actually a journalist and non-fiction author as well, so this is her first work of fiction. And Catherine, welcome to Goldster.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this, as I say, is your very first novel. Tell us, what was it like to write fiction after writing non-fiction for so long?
It was quite a different experience. So I first started with writing non-fiction, as you said, and books for children. And then I moved on to this book, which originally was conceived as non-fiction because it was based on a true story from my Norfolk hometown. And then it kind of changed to fiction because I found that I had lost the trail of the girl I was following from my hometown. So I felt I had no choice but to fictionalize it. So it was like learning a new craft. And I spent quite a lot of time reading about how to write historical fiction and going to sort of literary events about historical fiction and realizing it was a craft that I needed to learn about, just as I'd had to do that with journalism and nonfiction as well.
I didn't actually realize it was intended to be nonfiction at first. I remember we've spoken about it at the Society of Authors. I just knew of it as a novel. So this is really interesting to me. So what was the moment that you thought, I'm going to have to give up on her. I can't find anything else. And what did your agent say?
So I suppose the decision was, I went to hear a talk by the fantastic writer, Kate Summerscale, who's written Victorian nonfiction, but written them as sort of narrative nonfiction, the most brilliant books. And I remember going up to her at the end of the talk and explaining my dilemma. And, she said, well, sometimes it's not that easy to find so much information for Georgian times. It was that bit earlier. Obviously, there's no photographs at that point. It's all recorded material. So I kind of had to take the jump into fiction. So my agent is an agent for nonfiction. So I kind of had to decide to kind of go it alone as well, because he doesn't actually agent me for fiction. So I kind of had to make this big decision, a bit of a leap of faith.
Yeah.
And it took a long time. You know, it took longer because I was sort of learning how to write fiction at the same time.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, that's such an interesting journey. We're going to come back to that later. But tell us the true story behind your novel. Who are your characters?
So I came across this sort of snippet of a story about a woman who had been buried at the sort of end of my hometown, which is in Norfolk. It's a small market town called Harleston, and she'd been buried on what's called the parish boundary, so where two boundaries meet. And there's no gravestone, there's nothing to mark that she was buried there. And that's because she was buried with this archaic punishment called felo de se, which is where you're staked through the heart after death. And it's a punishment sort of put on your body after death because you're deemed to have committed an offence before you died. In her case, she was had been arrested on suspicion of infanticide, and she'd then died by suicide, and that's also was then still a crime. So she was the town of Harleston went and watched her being staked through the heart. There's a description of it. And so then I found out there was this one child who'd been left who was surviving, and she was sent to an orphanage in Hackney, and so I followed her trail.
And it's such a shocking story. I mean, did they think that by doing that, mutilating her body after death, that she would then never get into the afterlife or whatever? What was the reason behind this hideous practice? And can you give us the dates for this as well, so people get an idea of when it was?
Yes. So Mary Tyrrell, so Anne's mother, who's called Hannah in The Low Road, she was staked through the heart after death in 1813. And then Hannah arrives in London 4 years later in 1817. the practice of fellow de se was precisely that. I think it was a kind of mix of Christian and superstition kind of practices, because it was designed so that the ghost of this person wouldn't wander. So they were put on the parish boundary for that reason. It was very archaic, very rare. And in fact, she was probably one of the last people in England who that happened to, because it was outlawed in Parliament, I think, a matter of less than 10 years later.
So it really shocked me how late the date was. It's the kind of thing I was expecting to have been, you know, the 1400s, the 1500s. I was so shocked that it happened in the 1800s.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in Hansard, when parliamentarians were debating it, they said exactly that. They said it was really archaic. Why are we having such sort of hideous punishment on people after death? So that's why it was, that's why it was banned. But there's a few little signs of it around the country. There's quite a famous young boy from the Gypsy community who was buried similarly in Essex. And apparently people still, because the oral tradition is very strong in the community, they go and lay flowers at that crossroads where he's buried, but nothing Mary remains. There's nothing there. There's no plaque. There's no bench. There's no cross. She disappeared from my hometown's history.
So tell us how you discovered her, if she'd been so eradicated from history.
She was just a snippet of information about a walk which went past this area of the hometown called Lush Bush, which is a kind of soggy, boggy area at the end of the town. And it said that there were two people buried there. One was Mary Tyrrell, and the other one was a man who'd been buried there like 50 to 100 years earlier, who'd been accused of murdering his wife and had also, I think, died by suicide. And so the fact that she'd had a remaining daughter, I just wanted to know what had happened to her. And that was Anne Tyrrell. And she was, she was then sent away 4 years later. A collection of money was got up in the town and she was sent away to an orphanage in Hackney. So she disappeared from Harstall's history again as well. And the only other mark of the family was that the superintendent of the orphanage she then went to in Hackney wrote to a lawyer in my hometown and said that she went to Botany Bay. She was sent to Botany Bay in 1828. And that's really the germ of the whole book.
Yeah.
Her mother dying and being sent to London. And then she was transported to Botany Bay.
Wow. So tell us when you first started researching this and how you did your research. Where did you go to?
So I was a Royal Literary Fund fellow when I first sort of came across the story, and I was teaching 2 days a week at the London School of Economics. So between sessions, I'd use the brilliant library and I'd research as much as I could the real history. So I was looking at local archives in East Anglia and the National Archives in London in sort of term recess dates. And then in between sessions, I was doing things like reading Elizabeth Fry's letters and diaries, because so Anne went to this orphanage, she met another girl, they almost certainly had a relationship, and then they kind of went and stole all the refugees' laundry and ended up in the Old Bailey. So there were all these traces of them all the way through sort of London's sort of rackety history. And luckily, because archives are increasingly digitized, I could find these traces of them. And so I traced them all the way to being transported, but not beyond. So I spent that time, that 7 years, working on it whilst working. So I did my sort of stint as a fellow, then I went back to journalism. And for me, I can't write like very regularly. I need to write in big chunks of time. So I'd kind of earn enough to write, take some time off, write, go back to journalism, do some more work, earn enough to take time off. I'm not someone who is really good at writing in snatches of time. You know, like Trollope wrote, I think, for 2 days, 2 hours a day before going to his job at the post office. Not everyone has that discipline, maybe.
And also, I think it helps if Trollope had a regular job at the post office. Most of us writers have so many different jobs. We're teaching, we're doing all sorts of other things. I think what you've just said is so valuable, because so many authors, I don't think people realize how many authors have to afford to be able to write. When you said that, that really got to me, saying, yes, that's like so many of us. We have to earn money doing other things to be able to afford to do our actual job. And I just like you to explain to everybody what being a Royal Literary Fund Fellow is. It's something that you and I have both done, and it's an amazing scheme. Do you want to tell them about what it is?
Yes, so it's an amazing fellowship run by the Royal Literary Fund, which basically funds writers to go into universities and increasingly other workplaces, actually, and teach, in the case of universities, teach students really how to improve their academic writing, their critical thinking. And it's a fantastic scheme because you write, you work for 2 days with one-to-one sessions with students, and then for the other days, that kind of stipend that you're given means that you've got a bit more time to write. So it's an amazing scheme, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's now been extended, I think, to sixth form centres and community centres as well. So it's become bigger, which is fantastic. It's ambitious.
Yeah, I having been a Royal Literary Fund Fellow as well, I thought it was a wonderful scheme. I met some fascinating people. And I would say to anybody who's listening who've got people they know going to universities, or as you say, some sixth form colleges, they should seek out their RLF fellow, because I think most people don't know that it exists and it's such a brilliant resource.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. It's amazing.
I've got a question here, which I'm going to ask. This is so apposite at this moment. I'm not being superstitious, she says, but I can't help to ask, do you think the spirit of the woman who was unjustly killed inspired you to write the book? Someone said some writers are inspired by the spirits of those gone to write their stories, which end up having a huge impact. Maybe you are one. Have you ever felt that?
I think that's such a great question, because I actually felt like Hannah was someone whose story needed to be told. And this was, you know, I wanted to kind of recuperate her voice from history. And I did feel very much that. So Hannah was accused of pilfering, and sorry, a Hannah in the book and in real life, just because there were two Annes.
Right.
She was accused of pilfering in Harleston, in my hometown, before she was left. So they kind of got rid of her because she was up to no good. And I remember when I arrived in Harleston as a child of 7 from a mining town in Leicestershire, both my mum and dad were teachers, and they were then teachers in that town. I shoplifted. Like, I got into shoplifting to give people stickers on lunchboxes because I wanted to make friends. It was as simple as that. Yeah, it was actually really sad, but there was a bit of me that thought I pilfered when I was a little child, just like Hannah. So sorry, this is my son, which should have been switched off. So I did exactly that, and I feel that Hannah wanted me to tell her story, and I've done the best I could by her. I also think, as a woman, as someone who's really interested in women's history more generally, I wanted to tell that story because it was a way of hearing women's voices that often they are only heard through their accusers in history, especially young women like this who ended up as convicts.
Yes, and I was going to ask you about that, because being a historian, I know how difficult it is to research people who weren't, you know, big in the past. They weren't famous for doing something or infamous for doing something. To try and find out the lives of everyday people is often a really tough journey. Did you find it more difficult to find out the stories of real people rather than, you know, the royal family or whoever?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was E.P. Thompson that talked about how the stockingers and the weavers' voices are sort of lost from history. And in his sort of History of the Working Class, he makes this massive attempt to get those voices back. It's the most amazing piece of nonfiction. And I wanted to do something similar with Hannah and Annie, which was to get their stories back into history. And of course, the only traces I had of them was them. So for instance, in the Old Bailey, saying they were very sorry for stealing all the laundry from the refuge, or Hannah being admitted to the refuge and saying she understood, she was sensible, I think was the phrase, that her mother had committed this iniquity, which was being accused of infanticide. So there were these kind of little clues, but what they really thought, I didn't get much traces of. There was one entry in the refuge for the destitute minutes, which was that Hannah was returned to the orphanage when she'd been in service for just 6 weeks, and she was dismissed for being idle, impertinent, and dishonest. And I thought that was an amazing, because I thought, well, one, I think she wanted to go back to be with the other girl who she was clearly very, very close to, but also she was feisty, you know.
Yeah.
and
couldn't fit the mold, but they had to get rid of her.
Yeah, and she was resilient. Clearly, if she survived her mother's horrific, what happened to her mother and her sister, there was something about her that meant that she just had this spirit to continue.
So if we go back for a minute to her mother and to the infanticide, were you able to find out any more about that? What were your feelings about what had happened in that case?
I mean, it is the kind of mystery at the core of the book, or the jumping off point for the book. I looked at the minute. I looked for as many parish archives as I could. And what I think may have happened is that I suspect that the mother was violated in some way, and that happened, and therefore, and she couldn't cope with having two, what would then have been called base-born children, which is children born out of wedlock. So her first child, Hannah stroke Anne, is entered in the parish register. She was christened, but it says she was base-born. So that's already a black mark against the mother's name. But to have one might have been excused, and clearly she was living in the parish. To have two, she might have ended up in the workhouse, and then, you know, they would have been separated eventually. And clearly the mother must have been at her wit's end. But the minutes, so the parish records were very useful in the Norfolk Record Office, and I found things like the original entry where it had been written that the baby was wrapped in black baize, and the baby was buried in the churchyard but not given a proper sort of Christian burial because she hadn't been christened. And there was the note about the jury on the mother's body. So they went and visited her body in the local pub, which is still there, and had an inquest. Whether you sit on the body, it's called, where you go and look at the dead body and you decide why the person died. So I found quite a bit in the archives, actually, and I absolutely fell in love with archival research. I'm sure, Lucinda, you feel the same. Something about, yeah, it's a total thrill, actually. I'd love to do more.
It is a total thrill. And what's so wonderful is talking to someone else who feels that, because people who don't do that, they just think, how boring. Whereas actually, you know, it's like being a detective. It really is. It's fascinating, the things that you can discover. The difficulty is not letting yourself go down all those rabbit holes where you discover something else fascinating that's totally off topic, but you completely want to follow it.
I did find, I'm sure I did go through down rabbit holes as well, because, I mean, one of the reasons the book took so long was money. The other was family bereavement, but I think the third was many, many rabbit holes. And so I would definitely hold my hands up. I mean, the things I kept on finding, like notations that in the Refuge of the Destitute, there were black young orphans. I know that's something that has emerged in sort of the history of London recently, but I was like, wow. And they're described so respectfully, you know, not what you'd expect at all. So it was that kind of thing that makes you think there's another story there.
There really is. And there's some amazing work done by historians, people like David Olushoga, but it's so frustrating that so many people think that, you know, that multiculturalism is something that happened in the last few decades. Whereas, of course, we're in a series of islands. There's always been people arriving from all over the world. And it's great when you can write history of everyday people and realize these things. People get so cross if a historic book is, you know, filmed and people say, oh, it's so woke. They just don't know history, do they? They just don't realize how there are people from all over the world on this little collection of islands.
Exactly. And that just shows you that we were always here, like, you know, coming from a dual heritage background myself. It's actually very nice to be put back into history. And not necessarily Middle Eastern people like me, but other, you know, to know that there were always black people, Chinese people. It's fantastic to just have back into history. And these are the silences that are kind of being broken now. It's not just working class poor girls like Hannah and Annie. It is those other silences as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about, you said they got transported to Botany Bay. So tell us about your research after they've been transported.
Yeah, so I managed to get a grant. This was the Society of Authors, so thank you very much, to go to Australia. I was supposed to go in 2017. I actually ended up going a year later. And just by coincidence, that was quite a big celebration or commemoration year in Australia, because there were 13 work factories where women convicts were sent in Australia if they didn't become servants immediately, which is called assignment. And there was a commemoration of the Parramatta Work Factory, a very famous one, just downriver from Sydney along the Parramatta River. And so I went. I was lucky enough to go to the commemoration there and not only see the very well-preserved factory, but there were people sort of dressed up as characters of the time. There were the actual fruit bats in the trees that would have been presumably descendants of the fruit bats that sort of shrieked over the Parramatta River at that time. And there were descendants. And one thing that is incredible about going to Australia is seeing this embrace of what used to be the convict stain and is now a pride in convict history.
Yeah.
And also coupled with that, which I think is really important, is the acknowledgement that Indigenous communities lost so much through colonisation of Australia. And I think that needs acknowledging. You know, they were evicted, children were taken away, there were mass killings. So that's also being talked about and acknowledged. And here in the UK, what I find interesting is that even though many of us will have convict roots, we don't know about it, but everyone in Australia has done their family tree. And we don't really talk about transportation. We do talk about slavery, but not about transportation. The two are all part of our empire.
Ooh. So how do you think we change that? What kind of conversations would you like to see happening?
Well, I personally would like to see a Museum of Transportation in the UK, because I think it's the counterpart to slavery. I think we need to understand our history so that we can kind of go forward. Just now, we've got the barge being moored for asylum seekers off Portland Bay, it is. And, you know, that's people wanting to, where they're seeking asylum, they're applying for refugee status. But at the same time, 200 years ago, exactly 200 years ago, Hannah and Annie were being held on a prison hold at Woolwich, and they were going to be forcibly exiled. So this has always happened. We've always used prison hulks and barges to house people who we don't want to have on the shores. And there's a, you know, there are all these echoes in history that I think are really resonant. So I would like to see some kind of commemoration of transportation. We don't even have anything like along the River Thames that would have seen people being rowed off to the hulks at Woolwich, being rowed from the Old Bailey and Newgate along to the penitentiary where Tate Britain is. We have absolutely no signs of that history. It's lost, but it could be put back again.
Sounds like an amazing plan, and I really, really hope that it would happen, because it is, as you say, a part of our history that's just been forgotten, but it's a hugely important part. And so many of them were women who just ended up stealing because they had no choice. They were trying to feed themselves, feed their children. And so many of those people have been forgotten. So it would be an amazing project to do. So what happened to them when they got to Australia? And what kind of help did you get with the research when you were out there?
Yeah, so 26,000 women were transported to Australia during the whole sort of transportation history. They were just two of them. I used a kind of mosaic of real women's lives to tell the story of Hannah and Annie once they arrived at Botany Bay, then called Sydney Cove. One of them actually I kind of sent to Van Diemen's Land, as it was called then, now called Tasmania. The other one to the Hunter Valley, which is just north of Sydney, and gave them very sort of different fates. And, you know, the thing hanging over them is, will these two people who were so important to each other then come together at the end? So I gave them these different fates that were very much based on true women's lives. I had huge amounts of help from historians in Australia, from local historians in Tasmania, in Hobart, where I visited the Cascades female factory, probably one of the grimmest of the female work factories across Australia. I went to the Hunter Valley and met with local historians there. I used the archives, very good online archives, went to lots of historical places to get a sense of what would this landscape have felt like and smelt like, sounded like, as much as possible. That kind of trying to immerse yourself in something that happened 200 years ago is really challenging, and it really helps to go there if you can. And I'm not Australian, so I hope I've done that history justice. I listened to lots of bird song, something I really love, listened to lots of natural sound, read natural history of the time. So I did all of that. I loved it. And had you been to Australia before, or was this your first trip?
No, it was my first trip. I have family in New Zealand, but not in Australia. So yeah, so I'd never been.
And do you know, have there been much interest in this book in Australia yet? I know it's only very recently out.
Yeah, so I've been, the summer review's coming out in Australia. The book's being published in the US in the autumn, and I understand that then it's easier to get books to Australia. It's quite expensive to get them to Australia from here, but there's a book club's reading it in Australia. So it is sort of happening in Australia as well. I also worked with the Conviction Politics Project in Australia, which is a big multi-university UK-Australian arts council project looking at who was transported as well. So they've been really helpful and I've really enjoyed working with them. Trade Union Congress has been involved with that project. So lots of different, I've worked with lots of different people and it's just been fascinating. It's like, it's always a labour of love and it ends up being a collaborative effort, weirdly.
Yeah, no, it does, definitely. And talking about collaboration, something that we were talking, you know, we've talked about before with the book, let's talk about collective trauma. What is that and how does this apply to this book?
I think you could sort of make an argument that there's sort of three collective traumas that are woven through the book, with the first being that of the town where I grew up, which was, a modest and still is a sort of modest, quiet market town with lots of agricultural workers. And I imagine them at the end of the day effectively being forced to go and see this awful thing happen to someone who they would have known, who would have gone shopping for provisions in the market and worship with them in church. So there's that collective trauma of, you know, Mary almost being a kind of held up as a punishment for other people. And I find that very salutary to think that that happened to the descendants of people I went to school with in that market town. So there's that. Then there's the kind of trauma of these girls who were sent to refuges in places like Hackney. And I did a discussion at the Hackney Archives. And what is, I think, really moving is that there were many refuges for girls and women. Also girls and women who had been brought to the UK, Ayahs and so on, from India, and then abandoned. So there were many of those refuges. And the collective trauma of girls and women who weren't really listened to, who didn't have a lot of choice and control over their lives. And lastly, the big collective trauma of Indigenous communities in Australia and what we kind of, you know, as British people, what we left there. So you had the trauma of the convicts who were exiled, forcibly exiled from their country. And then you have this parallel trauma of what happened to the communities that they displaced. And those two are sort of haunt the last third of the book, I suppose.
Yeah. So you talked as well about men sitting in judgment on women's bodies. And we talked that very forcibly with that at the very beginning of the story. How did that chime, do you think, with what's happening in the world today? Do you think this is still a problem?
Yeah, I mean, we've just had the case of the young woman who was convicted. And I'm not taking sides in what happened to her unborn fetus, but to an extent, she was convicted of a very late term abortion and then sent to prison. Her sentence has now been reduced. And there is always this sense of, you know, the law can sometimes feel quite a male institution. Certainly in Hannah and Annie's time, in Georgian times, it was obviously completely male. A jury would have been male. All the judges would have been male. The rector of the town was also the magistrate. You had men in every part of their lives sitting in judgment on them, but also being the people who would have violated women, who would have got them into trouble, would have got them pregnant, and then, you know, used women and sent them away.
And taken no responsibility.
You know, what on earth happened to this poor agricultural worker that she ended up pregnant with a child she didn't want? Something happened and someone did that to her. But that question was never asked during the questioning that she was subjected to.
Yeah.
I think that runs like a thread, is men sitting in judgment on women. And then those surprising men who don't do that, you know, because there are always men who thought independently and realised, like William Godwin, who married Mary Wollstonecraft, huge
huge example of that. You know, there were always men who supported the rights of women all the way through as well. It's not like that didn't happen.
Mm.
Yeah, it isn't a man-hating book at all. There's some very good men in the book.
And we've had a very insightful question here. Did writing this story have an impact on your well-being?
That's such a great question. Writing one of the scenes towards the end did make me cry, which is kind of strange, isn't it? Writing it, you know, that your own writing should make you cry more, because I think because towards the end of writing it, you know, I'd gone through quite a lot of bereavement. So there were quite a lot of resonances for me when people died in the book. So I think there's a bit of, you know, you haunt your own book in some ways, to go back to that idea of the haunting as well. And whatever happens to you permeates the book. So I think it didn't, I suppose writing for 7 years was took quite a toll on me, but I'm so glad I did it and completed it. And my first writing teacher ever, who was this wonderful acerbic playwright called Leanne Orkin, I remember her saying to me years ago, "Catherine, you just have to finish something, because only then can you start the hard work, which is the editing, right?" So has always been my touchstone, finish it.
That is great advice. So for all of you Goldsters people out there who are working on your projects at the moment, you have it here. You've just got to finish something. So what top tips can you share? Because we do have quite a lot of people here who are writing perhaps for the first time or continuing things they've done in the past. What would you say to people who are working on something at the moment?
I'd say just channel your inner Leanne Orkin and finish it for a start. Even if it's a short story, flash fiction, doesn't, or a podcast, it doesn't matter what it is, give it a beginning, a middle and an end. And also, I had some great advice the other day from another fantastic novelist called Marika Kobold, who said, even if you're not sort of managing to write every day, what you can do is set aside 5-10 minutes to think about what you want to write, or scribble down some ideas about your plot. And I think that was such great advice, because sometimes you're not in the right zone for writing, but you might be able to wrangle a problem that you've got, a plot hole, or you might be able to think, oh, how would I go about this character, writing this character? Also, listen in on buses. That's really good advice. Can't remember who told me that. Also, use journalists a lot. Just shamelessly eavesdrop on trains and buses, because you hear the most amazing snippets. I'm not saying you should then like completely steal it, but you could get a little snippet, a hook. Read local newspapers as well. I think that's great advice.
That is really good advice. Yeah. If you've still got a local newspaper, they're quite hard to achieve sometimes. But yeah, local newspapers are full of wonderful human interest stories. Now, we've got a comment here. That's very good advice, because I tend to get discouraged by the loneliness of writing on my own for hours. Do you ever feel that, Catherine? Do you feel there's a loneliness in writing?
Yeah, I do, actually. And in fact, I've got a very tiny writing group. There's only 3 of us. And we do sometimes meet up for tea, a cup of tea, and more like we don't really swap each other's writing hugely at the moment, but we will talk about things around writing, and anything like that is great. I think book clubs are fantastic, and writing clubs are even sort of, they're good too. Like, I think you almost need both if you're a writer, because you also be a reader, right?
Absolutely. You need to read as much as possible. Yes. So going on, so you talked about plotting. So obviously this was the first time you'd written fiction and you started writing it as nonfiction. What then happened? Did you have to take a step back and start writing a plot, or did you continue with what you'd already got and plot from then onwards? What was your process?
The process was really to break the book into the 3 parts. So that was really very loosely Norfolk / East Anglia, then London, then Australia, Tasmania. So, and kind of try and plot those almost separately. But I suppose the strange thing is that I always knew what I wanted the ending to be. So the bit that I found most difficult was what you might call the sticky middle, because Norfolk had not been written about at this time, hadn't been written about very much. So I felt, okay, I can write this. London, I found incredibly hard, because so many amazing writers have written about London. I mean, Dickens, obviously, being the most obvious example of that. You know, it felt very humbling to write about London. Sarah Waters wrote about the Millbank Penitentiary.
Brilliant.
Brilliant book. There were lots of people whose work I'd read on London, so that was difficult. Australia, there's these great titans of Australian literature, you know, like Kate Grenville. Then I met Meg and Tom Keneally when I was there. You know, it was kind of frightening. It was wonderful.
Australia as well.
Yeah, but also like, this is kind of frightening. Also because I wanted to make sure that I got, you know, writing or not writing or getting the balance on writing about Indigenous communities right. So every different bit had different loopholes and potholes for me, but I did plot it in the same way that I would have plotted nonfiction in terms of chapters, but then I moved everything around a lot. I played around with voice, tried it in close post third person, something that the novelist Emma Darwin talks about a lot is point of view. Then I decided to write it in the first person, but it went through huge number of iterations. In fact, I'm not even sure how many iterations it's gone through. I'd have to count them. Many, many edits. So I'd say that for every edit that I tried, I then scrunched it up, threw it away, tried again, did what the writing teacher Andrew Willey calls the retype edit, which is where you just completely rewrite the whole thing. So it really is
dark.
It's dark and so hard, but he says that there's something about the very act of retyping it again that changes your writing, and it actually did work. Like, it did really help.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm going to have to try that. Well, I'm learning lots. I hope that everybody else is learning lots as well here. People are talking about how you talked about writing, having a writing group, having lost that during the pandemic. Perhaps, and as somebody here is saying that her friends all passed away due to the pandemic, which is heartbreaking. I'm so sorry to read that. She says, I suppose my writing is now impacted by the thoughts of those three. Perhaps I ought to write in their memory. What a lovely idea that is.
That's such a beautiful idea. And there's something about how grief permeates writing that I think always gives it depth. And what a wonderful way to remember the people who you lost, actually. Condolences, because that's a huge loss. I think there's been great writing about grief, but I think this is definitely an area that could be written about more.
Yeah.
Necessarily that, but the fact that grief is part of our human condition just as much as birth, and it's something that is still shied away from, but I think is really important to write about, actually.
Yes. We had Sasha Bates, who writes about grief, on Goldster a few months ago, and it was really good to hear what she was saying. And it was a similar thing, you know, that we are so divorced from death and talking about death in this society that actually when you are hit with grief, it's extremely difficult to talk about that because most people don't want to. It's a kind of embarrassing subject. Did you find when you were writing this book, because it's such a heartbreaking subject, did you find that people were embarrassed when you told them about it, or were they intrigued? What were the reactions when you said what your next book was?
I think everyone was really intrigued about that kind of what you might call the origin story of the book, actually. I didn't find that people shied away from it, but I did warn a few people that it wasn't really a beach read. It was more of a take a deep breath and it will be okay in the end, but it's a bit grim at times read. So that's something I have said to people is don't, you know, be prepared, you know, not exactly a trigger warning, but something along those lines of, you know, it's not easy at times.
Yeah. And that is real life, isn't it? I mean, I've cried when I've been writing parts of the biographies I've written because of the sad things that happen to all of us, that happen to people in life. And it's very hard reliving that when you are writing somebody's life, or say living it through their story. Would you like to keep writing fiction, or will you go back to nonfiction, or do you want to keep writing both? What was this experience like for you?
I absolutely love this experience. And I am now writing a crime series. So I got an Arts Council grant, which I'm really grateful for. So it gave me a little bit of time, a bit of a breather in the same way as the RLF. So that, again, is more like a little bit of historical crime, but it's something I really want to do. She's using a journalist as the protagonist rather than a detective. But I'm also... there's other stories that I didn't explore in the book. I just think the swing rioters in England and the Southwest, so these are agricultural workers who sort of rose up against industrialization. I quite like to explore that history. It feels like it's really been, again, quite forgotten. Mm-hmm. And so there's that as well, that I kind of wouldn't mind going back to, is that that wonderful history of, you know, ordinary people whose voices have been not heard for a long time.
Yeah. Do you think this story that you've written has, thinking about the one you were just talking about, do you think it has lessons for today? What can people learn from the experiences of these people?
That's such a great question. I hope that they would learn that everyone has a reason for what they do. And when you read the stories of women in prison today, who are so often dismissed, you know, you realise that so many of those women would have experienced horrific trauma in their childhoods, and there was something inevitable that led them to that place. And which is why I think prisons need to also be places not only of punishment, but of recovery and rehabilitation, because someone like Hannah would have been written off. She was, you know, she was a thief, but she was also a human being who lost her mother and who saw incredible childhood trauma. And you could apply that to lots of stories today. So I think for me, that would be the thing, is there are people in prison, both men and women, and young offenders, who are there, you know, as a result of what happened to them, and they need as much compassion as punishment.
Yeah. So one thing we haven't talked about yet is your journalism. So take us back to the beginning of your journalistic career and how it led you to the point of writing these books.
So I always wanted to be a writer. I remember like writing terrible poetry when I was 7 in Halstead, actually, and thinking I just want to be a writer. But I didn't really know how people were writers, even though my grandmother had written a book about wartime Yugoslavia. It wasn't kind of really in the family. So I did student journalism at university, then did a master's because I just thought I wasn't ready for the workplace. And then I managed to get a traineeship as a journalist, as a financial journalist, which I never really got to the bottom of, really. I was like not very good at financial journalism. But and I was rescued. I went to work for the Labour Party briefly, and I was rescued by a wonderful TV producer called Linda McDougall, who took me under her wing and gave me a job in TV. And then I kind of thought, okay, now I can actually have some fun. So I went into TV, worked with wonderful people like Linda, and then spent many happy years at the BBC, and then went back into print journalism at that point. And I had 2 young children, and I now do mainly environmental journalism, cross-border environmental journalism, so working with teams across Europe, looking at sort of journalism related to climate reporting. But I also do social affairs reporting and work on really what's children in the care system is something I'm really interested in, which is parallel to what happened to the girls in the book. Fostering, sort of equality journalism, I suppose. So I am really lucky that I'm still working. I'm in my 50s, and a lot of journalists, it becomes harder to carry on. But I've just found a little niche, and so I'm still kind of plugging away as a journalist.
Have there been particular stories as a journalist that have inspired you to write books, something that you've come across when you think, I'm going to write an article, and then it's grown into something else?
Yeah, I think for me, when I was working at a disability magazine in 2007, like, again, this is local journalism, actually, I came across the story of a young man who'd been starved and kept in a shed. He had epilepsy, and he then died. And I started working on journalism around that. It was called Disability Hate Crime. And then I wrote a book called Scapegoat that was about crimes against disabled people. So there was that. I came across a small snippet of an article about the Dale Farm Irish Travellers in 2006. And I was working at The Economist then. And again, I kept in touch with Irish Travellers there and followed that story through the eviction. And that led on to a book. So I do tend to get very interested in a subject and want to continue with it. At the moment, I'm looking at asbestos, and I can definitely see there's a non-fiction book in that. So if anyone wants to commission me, I'm there for that.
I've had a request for your website. I've actually put your website address into the chat already, but for anybody listening, it is katharinequarmby.com, and Quarmby is spelled Q-U-A-R-M-B-Y. I hope I'm pronouncing your surname correctly.
That's right. Yeah. It's your name. So
So you've written many other books. Can we talk about some of your earlier books?
So I started writing books for children, and I've just written some more, actually. The first book was based on my daughter, who was then a tiny fussy eater, and it was called Fussy Freya. And it really was about her and her relationship with her younger brother and the performativity around eating that she engaged in to get attention at that time. She's not fussy anymore, but I loved writing it. I also really liked writing in rhyme, and it's something that I'd love to do more of. Like, it's something really fun about writing in rhyme. And I'm still in a children's writers group, actually. So yeah, like, you don't have to be in just one. And I've just written a series of books for children about bullying that come out next year, and a book on disability rights for primary school children, which I think is the first such book for primary age children. That's with Hachette, so that comes out next year as well. So got quite a lot of books for children on the go. So those were the first books. And then I moved on to Scapegoat, the book about disability, and then onto the book about travellers, and then some shorter books of non-fiction and fiction, actually, some very short kind of couple of fiction books. One about the Rwandan genocide. I've bumped with the BBC to Rwanda twice after the genocide, and one about my own journey to being adopted as a baby in the UK from a transracial background, so about roots in Iran. So I've written quite a lot, but there's always room for more books, isn't there?
And tell us about The Priest, the Assassin, and Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Yes, so that was I think it's called a Kindle single, which is a short fiction book on Amazon. And that was actually about my adoptive mother's history. So she's a Serbian, Bosnian Serb, partly Spanish. And she had a grandfather who was the Archdeacon of Sarajevo. So he was an Orthodox priest. And it was said in family history, and apparently this is also true, is that he absolved Archduke Franz Ferdinand, really absolved him, but it's possible. So that was the story, that he had him before he went and assassinated the Archduke. So wow, that was the story behind it.
So do you enjoy writing both for adults and children? Would you like to keep doing both of those things? Not something you don't kind of have a choice to do just one. You'd like to keep writing for both.
Yeah, and I think I was looking, if you look at you know, the kind of writers who make it into Wikipedia, which is not me, but often you'll find that writers for adults also write books for children. And I think there's a lot of joy about writing books for children, and I've enjoyed every book that I've written, really. So I wouldn't want to give up on one for the other. And I also enjoy the nonfiction. So I'd want to kind of keep things open and feel that I could keep on writing. Because sometimes a book is right for one genre and not for another, isn't it? So,
yeah. We just had a comment because the audio broke up a little bit. They'd like you to reiterate the part about Gavrilo Princip, please.
Oh, apologies for that. I hope it wasn't the audio here. So Gavrilo Princip, who assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand and sparked the First World War, one of the sparks. My mother's grandfather, he was called Kostas Bozic, was the Orthodox priest who was said to have absolved him from sort of guilt for the assassination before that. So he was said to have taken him into, I think, the cathedral and absolved him. And certainly Kostas Bozic was held in prison in, I think, Travnik, and he then got TB and he was released and then died. So he certainly was held in prison for those kind of crimes, but whether he technically absolved him is lost in the mists of history. But it's a good story.
It's a great story, and it inspired you to write a short tale about it. So I think it's wonderful. Now, as we all know, writing is very sedentary. So how do you keep healthy with your writing routine?
Yes, so I really love walking. So I tend to do a walk at lunchtime. It's still like the COVID walk, you know, it's still like in me, I think, the whole
thing. Interesting. So did you start doing it during lockdowns and it stayed with you?
Yeah, definitely. That was the walk. You know, I think you were allowed 2 walks if you had a dog and 1 if you did or something. So yeah, that was the walk, the proper lunchtime walk, but also yoga and swimming. Now I'm back on the bike, which is lovely. So all of those things really. But I think my first love is walking. And actually just going back to Lush Bush, my mum's walk, because she still lives in our hometown in Norfolk, was always past Lush Bush. So whenever I was allowed to visit, we'd go that way and I'd kind of salute Mary Tyrrell, you know, it just felt like the right thing to do. So every time we go past Lush Bush, I think about Mary, who's buried there. So yeah, walking with people and without people is a huge pleasure.
So you said that it took you 7 years to work on this book, which I have to say as a biographer doesn't sound that long. I've had books that have definitely taken that long. Did you feel when you stopped writing it, did you miss your characters?
Yeah, I do miss them, actually. I think about them a lot. I wonder what they would be doing. And, you know, I mean, one person said, so you're going to write a sequel, because it's left on a kind of pregnant pause. I was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. But I just kind of want them to feel that they still live on now. They've been resurrected. So I do miss them, actually, but because I was with them for such a long time and I had a very small... The spare room where people come and stay is also where I write. So one wall was covered with photographs and that I took and paintings of Norfolk. One was London, one was Australia, and one was the computer. So taking that all down and then painting the room was actually very emotional. There was something like, oh, I'm actually saying goodbye to them. Then I'm packing them away now.
Wow, I think that's such a fascinating thought that you literally physically packed them away. Maybe that was quite cathartic as well. Maybe it was time to move on to the next one.
Yeah, I think there is something. I don't know. I think other people have rituals around writing, but one of the things, if I do a big piece of journalism or nonfiction, I've always made that room a kind of room that's almost quite an immersive experience for me. And then I pack it all down afterwards. And that includes cork boards and things with pictures and writing and plans. It's everything. So the whole room is totally filled. So it feels like entering the world, but then you have to let the world go.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. We've got a question here. Is there anything you'd like to write which you haven't tried yet? I think that means different styles of writing. You've written for adults and children and journalism, fiction, nonfiction. What else is there in you?
One thing that I'd like to go back to, which I haven't done properly, I've only done in short sort of, I think they call them stage in French, so kind of rehearsal type things, is I'd like to do a puppet show. So I've had like very tiny school shows of some of my children's books, but I'd love to be, I wouldn't be the puppeteer because I'm not very deft, but I'd love to really get a puppet show at a puppet theatre.
No, I've got approval of that in the chat coming in. People like that idea. And thank you so much, Catherine. It's been a real joy having you on today. And I know we've met at various author events and I've heard about the journey of this book. And I'm so absolutely thrilled that you have finally had the chance to really do it justice, because I know what an important story this was to you. So well done. It's a huge achievement. And I'm just going to tell everybody what is coming up on Goldstart next. So just to let you all know that this month's book of the month is Sally Vickers' The Gardener. It's just such a lovely book. I'm really, really enjoying it. I haven't even finished reading it yet, but I'm really, really enjoying it. So I hope that you are too. Sally Vickers is a wonderful writer, and I'm really looking forward to discussing that with you all next Friday. But however, before then, we've got several important things coming up. So on Monday evening at 6:30, we have a special new type of Goldstart in conversation with Lee from Goldstart, who many of you Goldstart people know, is going to be talking to Lisa Snowden, and that's at 6:30. It's free. Anybody can join. There's information on the website, so tell your friends and do pass it on your social media as well. And then we've got an author to author on the 26th of July, and this is Humphrey talking to Charles Cumming, who was approached for recruitment by the UK's Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6. And he's written his first espionage thriller, A Spy by Nature. That was published some time ago, published in 2001. But it was partly based on his experiences with MI6. And he's going to be talking to Humphrey about his writing and also about being a spy. And then on Thursday, Humphrey is back again at Riverstone this time. So you can either, if you applied, you can go live. But otherwise, of course, as always, log on via Zoom. And he's talking to Maggie Piggott, who is the Vice Chair of Open Age, Life's Just Begun. She's published several critically acclaimed books, including How to Age Joyfully, 8 Steps to a Happier, Fuller Life, which has, by the way, been praised by Dame Judi Dench. You can't get much higher than that. And then, as I say, I'm back with you on Friday with Book of the Month, Sally Vickers, The Gardener. So thank you all so much. I've got comments coming in thick and fast from people. Yeah, really, really interesting conversation. I totally agree. Take care, everybody. Have a lovely weekend. And Catherine, thank you so much for coming on to Gold Star. And good luck with whatever you're working on now. We want you to come back in the future and tell us about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Gold Star podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.